Annie was cold, and she felt horribly embarrassed, sitting there trussed into the seat of the Russian helicopter, unable to move, unable to pull her clothes into position. She had no idea how long Forrest Blackburn had been gone, but she found herself wishing for his return. She was powerless to free herself, and if he didn't return, she would die here, strapped into this seat, with her skirt up to her crotch and her panties at her ankles. Annie would simply die of starvation or exposure, or perhaps the new world held other terrors she couldn't imagine. For him to violate her, he would have to free her. At least she assumed he would, and then she would have a chance. Maybe.
All right. This looks bad, Annie. But O'Rourke never gives up. O'Rourke never gives up.
She shut her eyes. If she could concentrate on something besides fear and the cold, she would be all right, she knew. She pictured Paul's face. It was a good face. Annie realized she was smiling. Someday the thinning hair would probably be gone, and there would only be a fringe of hair. She could kid him about being bald and rub the top of his head. Annie could tell him she was shining it for him. She wondered how it would be to make love. She wanted to be the first to give herself to Paul. She opened her eyes suddenly. She had seen Forrest Blackburn in her mind. Now he stood beside the bubble.
Miss me, Annie?
Blackburn untied her gag.
Go to hell!
Not today. I found my supplies. We'll fly there now. Should take us about 2 minutes or so. Then we load up.
He rested his right hand on her naked right thigh. She tried to recoil from him, but couldn't.
And then we're off to old Mother Russia. By the time we get there, Annie, well, you better decide. Either you warm up to me or you're dead. And I'll make sure it'll be a very unpleasant death.
She wanted to tell him, go ahead, kill me now. She didn't. She said nothing. Annie had something else inside her that was part of being O'Rourke. Patience. She focused her attention on Natalia. Natalia would know what to do. Annie learned that her mind, in ways she heard were impossible, could see what could not be seen. She remembered the dream of Michael in danger when he truly was in danger. Annie Rourke closed her eyes again. She tried to see Natalia. Natalia would know. In Annie's mind, she thought she saw Natalia wearing a once pretty black dress, but there was white powder on the dress, and the dress was somehow torn from the hem to the waist. Natalia. Annie focused her mind on one thought. Natalia.
This way is clear.
Natalia Anastasia Temirovna led the way for the escape party. Eva Mann carried one of the healthy, if somewhat small, twin girls, Hugo Sturm, the other one. Sarah Rourke towed along the other two Sturm children, Bertol and Willy. Sarah's wounded arm hung in a makeshift sling. John Rourke and Wolfgang Mann carried a stretcher. It was plastic and inflatable, making a transparent air mattress with an integral pillow supported by lightweight stretcher rods made of some type of high tensile strength aluminum. On the stretcher lay Helena Sturm. She had delivered two babies. Natalia, because of her abilities, let the other two women carry babies or shepherd the children while she took point carrying a gun. Barefoot still, she moved along the tunnel. Her outfit was stained with plaster dust now. In her hands, she held one of the German assault pistols. It was a decent weapon, but the magazine capacity was too small for selective fire, she thought, even with the enforced three-shot burst control. She didn't like weapons with built-in burst control. Somehow the feel wasn't right, and she knew a great deal about the feel of weapons, more so than the feel of babies. She looked back once. The infants, wrapped in towels taken from the torture chamber where Helena Sturm delivered them, were so tiny and fragile. Natalia stood by in the chamber and watched as John Rourke helped Helena Sturm birth her babies. Natalia watched the pain in Helena Sturm's eyes and the joy there, too. She envied other women, their fragility and their strength. She kept walking. Overhead ran steaming pipes, though the air felt cold as the group walked on.
Up ahead there, Fraulein Major. Take the turn to the right.
By the dim light of the bare bulbs interlaced between the pipes, Natalia began following the tunnel where it forked to the right. Troops were closing earlier when Wolfgang Mann led them to the far end of the second basement. A panel of concrete blocks moved on weights when Mann inserted a bayonet into one of the seams between the blocks. and they passed through into the tunnel. Once they passed through the opening, Mann pushed the panel of blocks back into position. She had lent her own strength to it as well. Mann explained that all construction was supervised by the Army engineers, and he had been able to have the secret passageway built into the foundation. They climbed the sharply rising tunnel for some time, the younger boys tiring, their capture and subsequent rescue taking its toll. There had been another panel of concrete blocks to move aside that opened onto the service tunnel where water, electrical power, and communications lines ran. Closing the panel as they had the first one, they moved ahead. Mann warned that troops could have anticipated them and be waiting along the tunnel. The group followed the bend in the tunnel and stopped at another block wall.
This is the last of the panels.
Rest easy, Frostorm. All will be well.
Mann stepped to the wall. In his hand was the bayonet he carried strapped to his left shin with strips of elastic. Using one of the hand torches, he studied the seams between the blocks.
Here.
Mann inserted the tip of the bayonet. It was similar to those used with the M16, and pried. The concrete blocks began to move, as though somehow an irregularly shaped section were being cut from a chessboard. Natalia and Mann threw their weight to it, along with John Rourke, and the panel moved rapidly.
Let's go.
Rourke and Mann ran back to Helene Sturm and the stretcher. Natalia stepped through the opening in the wall surface into a cave. At the end, or mouth of the cave, perhaps 100 yards distant, gray light shone. Natalia moved the muzzle of the machine pistol left and right against the darkness. There was no movement.
Come ahead.
John Rourke and Wolfgang Mann carried the stretcher through the opening. Helene Sturm lay aboard, quiet. Rourke had given her a B-complex shot and a mild sedative as a relaxant. They set down the stretcher as Eva Mann and Hugo passed through carrying the mercifully silent newborns. Then Sarah passed with Willie and Bertel. Then with John Rourke and Wolfgang Mann, Natalia worked her weight against the panel of blocks, pushing it back into place. For some reason, she began thinking of Annie. What a wonderful young woman Annie had become. The group moved through the cave, Natalia on point.
Just outside, we travel up a path and then into the trees. There is a cave concealed there, where there is safety.
Natalia nodded only, her eyes adjusting to the gray light. It must be sunset, she thought absently. Again, she thought of Annie. For some reason, Natalia thought back to her youth. She was on her first assignment with Vladimir in Latin America. They were working through communist sympathizers deeply involved in the cocaine trade. She asked Vladimir about the morality of this, serving the people of the world by dealing with such men. He shrugged it off as necessity. But she made a mistake, and she fell into the hands of the cocaine dealers. One of them made no secret of his intention to rape her. Then he would kill her and explain her body had been discovered, that she had been murdered by the secret police of the established government. Natalia remembered the feel of his breath on her face. He told her that if she were good to him, he would see to it that she died well. If not, if she resisted, she would die very hard. She had done the only thing logic and training dictated. She made him feel good, aroused him, and at his most vulnerable, she murdered him with his own knife. Then she took up his assault rifle and fought it out with his three henchmen, killing them all and escaping in a stolen truck. For the life of her now, Natalia Anastasia Temerovna could not imagine why, after so many years, she thought of this while walking through a cave. And for some reason again, she thought of Annie.
After we reach this other cave, then Wolf, Natalia, and the three of us will go free Dieter Bern. It's now or never.
Yes, of course. The Nazis will never expect us to attack so soon after the raid on the youth building.
But Natalia's thoughts drifted again to Annie Rourke. Suddenly, Natalia was unreasonably cold. John Rourke sat at the mouth of the cave, hidden at the fringe of the jungle, reloading the magazines for his pistols. Wolfgang Mann sat opposite him. Both men wore SS dark gray BDUs Mann ordered brought to the cave, along with other supplies. Rourke was convinced of one thing. Mann was terribly thorough. While Natalia changed at the rear portion of the cave, Rourke and Mann discussed their predicament. Mann sketched out once again the structure of the detention area with a stick in the dirt between their feet.
The detention area is one side of a Gothic-looking structure of twin towers. It is located in the exact center of the complex. The first official building erected 5 centuries ago.
So the only entrance to the building is through the courtyard at the center. One gate at the front and one gate at the back.
That is correct, Herr Doctor. We must enter through the front. The rear gates are impassable. We must then enter the building from the left side of the courtyard. When you see the twin towers, do not be mistaken by their antique appearance. The exteriors are quite medieval, but the interiors are thoroughly modern. The walls on both the outside and the interior are cylindrical. In the tower at the very top is the detention area for political prisoners, such as Dieter Bern. He is the only one there now, unless new arrests have been made since I departed with the expeditionary force. It is 14 floors above the level of the ground. But I like your idea for escaping once Dieter Bern is freed.
It's the only way. Now the vehicle we're going to use to get inside, it's freshly stolen?
Yes. It will not be recognized as stolen from the internal security forces.
But the guards will recognize your face. They'll know that Natalia and I aren't in the SS.
By then the gate will be opened, and we have weapons. Remember, Herr Doctor, it is not important that I survive. What is important is that you and the Major reach the 14th level of the left tower and free Dieter Bern. Then you must get him from the tower to the communication center across the street. On the ground floor of the communication center, there are guards. There is a high staircase that leads to the upper level. There is where the communications facility is actually located, television and radio. The engineering controls are there as well. Major Tiamarovna, you are certain, can operate these controls if necessary?
She's very good at electronics, don't worry. It's getting there that's hard. Getting there fast enough that they don't cut the power on us. Where should the leader be?
After one has entered the courtyard, the building on the right is his headquarters. It is also where he lives. It is very secure, the Twin Towers.
Rourke turned as Natalia approached. Her hair was caught up under the peaked BDU cap, her uniform identical to theirs, except that it buttoned to the left, as women's clothing normally did. At her waist was a holstered German machine pistol. Slung from her right shoulder, the uniform purse. He knew why it appeared so heavy.
Ready?
Yes.
Rourke and Natalia rode in an electric vehicle, little larger than the golf carts of 5 centuries earlier, with Wolfgang Mann at the wheel. Rourke sat beside Mann. Natalia sat in the seat behind, enjoying the warmth of the air in the open-top vehicle. The vehicle slowed to a stop as it reached the complex. The number of main entrance guards quadrupled since Rourke passed through on the way to the new government building to free Helene Sturm. Two guards approached the vehicle on Wolfgang Mann's side. Rourke's hands were between his legs. He sat on one of the twin Detonics 45s. His hands were within inches of it. The closer of the two guards gave them a sharp look.
Papers?
All is in readiness, Herr Standartenführer. The signal has been received.
Very good, Hartmann.
These papers are in order. Allow this vehicle to pass.
Hartmann returned the papers. Mann eased the controls and the electric vehicle glided ahead. Mann kept his eyes on the road.
We are fortunate my men were able to insert themselves as planned. Hartmann, he is my most trusted captain. He transferred to my unit from SS Security 2 years ago. When I gave the radio signal for the attack to begin, he carried out the first phase personally as instructed. We are fortunate he was successful in taking over the guard barracks located by the main entrance. Otherwise...
John Rourke didn't like being dependent on good fortune. It had never been anything on which to depend. Mann's troops had not moved beyond taking the main entrance. It was the plan that they hold the front entrance under the guise of the SS security team and go no further, lest word reach the leader and lead to Dieter Bern's immediate execution. It was a good plan, as plans went, for insanely dangerous activities, Rourke mused, as again the vehicle slowed. Once again, the Detonic's minigun was beneath his rear end. He glanced down between his feet. A gray bag contained his Musette bag, the second Detonic's combat master, the two Scoremasters, the Python, the Gerber, the A.G. Russell Sting 1A black chrome hid beneath his uniform, and, more important than the weapons, his medical gear. Clamps for the artery, scalpel for the incision, small forceps for removal of the capsule containing the electrode and the explosive charge to release the curare-like synthetic into Bern's bloodstream. He knew the contents of Natalia's bag, a revolver, spare magazines for the machine pistol, and the lockpick set she would use to remove the shackle from Bern's neck after Rourke finished the operation. On the seat between Rourke and Wolfgang Mann sat another gray bag identical to Rourke's. It was, like the medical equipment and the uniforms, brought to the cave by military personnel loyal to Wolfgang Mann. The bag held special gear needed to cross the booby-trapped room, special gear Rourke requested of Mann after agreeing to go with him to Argentina and attempt the rescue of Dieter Bern. The vehicle stopped. The gates to the twin towers and the courtyard stood closed before them. They should have been open.
We have trouble.
It was familiar trouble to Rourke.
We cannot crash through the gates with such a vehicle. And I will be recognized as soon as the guards approach.
Follow my lead.
He reached for the small Detonix pistol he sat on. Then he arched his left eyebrow in signal to Natalia. She responded in kind. The guards approached. The nearest of the guards, a lieutenant in the SS, opened his mouth to speak. Then his jaw dropped. He started to run. John Rourke stood to his full height in the vehicle, the little Detonix 45 in hand above the windshield. Natalia's machine pistol opened up from behind Rourke in 3-round bursts. Rourke jumped to the ground from the front seat, jammed the little Detonix into his belt line, grabbed up his case, and threw its strap over his head and across his body.
You better be right, that fence isn't electrified!
Rourke ran to the gates some 10 yards away as Natalia and Mann leveled withering fire on the guards. Rourke took a running jump onto the gate. Both gloved fists closed over the spikes. Rourke's right leg found a purchase, then pulled himself up, then rolled over, dropping to the flagstones on the far side in a crouch, the machine pistol back in his hands. He saw guards at the entrance to their destination, the tower on the left. Rourke fired the machine pistol. He cut down one, then another, then a third guard with the last burst in his gun. Rourke buttoned up the magazine and rammed a fresh one up the well, working the slide release. Natalia sprung over the fence, landing like a cat on the ground beside him. She rolled across her back and rose to her knees. Mann caught his right sleeve as he climbed over the fence.
Go! Bullshit!
Natalia ran for the entrance to the left tower, a machine pistol in each hand. She wasn't strong enough to fire them accurately that way, Rourke realized. She was spraying lead from both weapons toward the oncoming guards. Rourke reloaded as Mann jumped clear of the fence, hitting the flagstone hard. Rourke glanced over to Mann, but he was already up, running, limping badly on his left foot.
Broken or sprained, I think.
Just keep moving on it!
Guards from the outside frantically worked to open the gates as Mann limped past Rourke to the left tower, where Natalia crouched in the doorway. One of the machine pistols lay on the floor beside her. She fired the second toward the guards at the far end of the cylindrical first floor. Rourke picked up her weapon, reloaded it with one of his magazines, then reloaded his own. Rourke, Natalia running beside him, Mann limping after them, charged into the building and past a picket of Nazi flagpoles. Three guards blocked the elevator banks. As Natalia leveled the guards, Rourke jammed two of the Nazi flagpoles through the door handles, temporarily locking the doors, then joined Mann and Natalia across the lobby. At the elevator banks, they stopped. Rourke glanced at Mann's injured foot.
Gonna have to be the elevator.
Agreed.
Natalia pushed the call button.
Cover you.
Rourke impatiently jabbed the button for the 14th floor.
Come on, come on!
If they should cut the power, Herr Doctor...
We'll lose this music, and Dieter Bern's dead.
Rourke crouched down and opened the bag on the floor beside him. He drew out his gun belt with the python and the magazine holder. He slung the belt around his waist. He slipped the double rig for the twin stainless Detonix pistols over his shoulders. As he reloaded the fired-out Detonix Combat Master, Rourke eyed the floor counter above the doors. He glanced at Natalia. She was buckling on her own guns. As she finished, she ripped the peaked BDU cap from her head, her almost black hair cascading to her shoulders. Rourke threw off his own hat. He smiled. It somehow wouldn't have the same effect as someone else watching. His hair didn't cascade. Mann was on his right knee, reloading the machine pistol.
Ready?
Rourke had one of the scoremasters in each hand as he stepped through and turned to two uniformed guards at the far end of the corridor.
Natalia, fix the elevators!
Of course! They're fixed!
Rourke reached a doorway at the far end of the corridor. There was a glass-enclosed switch on the wall beside the door. Rourke twisted half right, his left foot snapped up and out. He flipped the switch and the door slid open.
Man's information's good so far.
Rourke led the little group through the open doorway. At the far end of the well-lit room stood a cot. A frail human form lay on the cot. A chain led from a collar around the person's neck to the wall. It was Dieter Bern, and 2 feet in front of where Rourke stood were the first of the photoelectric eyes set to release synthetic curare-tipped spikes.
As you'll recall when we first talked of this mission, the entrance to and from the section where Dr. Bern is confined, and my commandos have confirmed the only means in or out, constantly broadcasts an identical electronic impulse. Should the current at the doorway be disrupted, an effect occurs similar to that of the Claymore-type mines used prior to the war between the superpowers. Thousands of tiny needles the size of slivers are released, traveling at such high velocity that they will penetrate up to a 6-millimeter thickness of armor plate.
They could see the photoelectric eyes framing the room on both walls, on the ceiling, and in the floor. The eyes formed an impenetrable spiderweb of light, but for the fact, John Rourke had planned ahead.
Natalia, let's get at it.
Wolfgang Mann lay prone by the entry door, 4 machine pistols beside him, 1 in his hands. He looked up.
Be careful, both of you.
Do you want something for your foot? A painkiller? There's not much time to do much else.
Pain will sharpen my senses, Herr Doctor. I will take nothing which would dull them now.
The figure chained to the wall, lying prostrate on the cot, began to stir.
Does Dieter Bern know you?
Yes. He was my professor many years ago.
Call to him. Tell him to lie still. That help is coming.
Rourke jogged along the cylindrically shaped outside wall corridor to where Natalia was setting charges of the German equivalent of plastique.
I think it is ready. Mann explained the chemical composition of their explosives. They are roughly 60% more potent than what I am used to with American C4. We should take cover.
She turned and they ran toward the main corridor as she strung out wire behind her. They found a corner there and took cover alongside the useless elevator banks. She touched 2 exposed wires together. Rourke and Natalia ran toward the debris of the explosion. A ragged 5x5-foot hole gaped in the wall. Rourke peered out. Below him, troops were forming, but no marksman could hit a moving target 14 floors straight up. He took Natalia's bag from her, securing it crossbody with his musette bag, opposite the heavier bag containing his medical equipment and spare ammo. Natalia had Mann's bag open, uncoiling rope from it and setting the rope beside it. She extracted what looked like a large CO2 pistol, a 3-bladed spear-like object protruding from the muzzle. Natalia pushed past him and leaned out the hole in the wall. She looked upward. She raised the pistol with the peculiar projectile toward the parapets that crowned the tower, some 20 feet above them.
Merde.
She smiled, settling the pistol in both hands. The spear shot upwards, the rope secured midway along the shaft, uncoiled from the light grasp in Rourke's hands. Rourke tugged at the rope to pull it taut. The rappelling hook had taken hold along the parapets, he hoped. Natalia took the rope from his hands. Rourke helped her up into the sill of the hole in the wall. Mann's bag was slung again from her side, a length of rope knotted about her waist. Rourke still held the other rope.
Be careful.
She swung out on the rope. Rourke watched Natalia edge along the wall back toward Bern's room. She positioned herself, then peered through a small surveyor's transit she pulled from Mann's bag. Mann had shown her photographs of the building to sight on to be certain of the spot where the charge should be placed. She secured an amorphous mound of plastique against the wall. Finally, she connected the wires.
Ready!
Rourke tugged at the rope, drawing Natalia back along the wall surface. She used her feet to rappel along it, near to the hole in the wall now. Rourke reached for her. His hands closed around her waist and he pulled her inside. She unhitched the wire connections from her belt.
Stand back.
Natalia touched the wires together. Rourke peered through the opening again. Due to the curve of the wall, he couldn't be sure how big a hole there might be. He hoped it was blown clear through. Below them, 14 stories down, men scattered as bricks and debris rained down. Mann was rappelling SS security forces.
Shit, we better get moving, ready?
He looked at Natalia.
Yes, ready.
Natalia, with Rourke's help, climbed back into the opening. Rourke climbed up behind her. Her arms folded around his neck, her face inches from his. Rourke launched them out, Natalia's legs tucked up, his feet taking the impacts of both their body weights against the wall. Rourke pushed out again. Again, their bodies crashed back toward the wall surface. Rourke's arms ached with the combined weight of Natalia's body and his own as he edged along the wall surface. They were 3 feet from the hole leading into Dieter Bern's cell. Rourke could see the cot through the hole in the wall. As he neared to within a foot of the hole, he reached out his left foot to yank them over and straddle the opening, 1 foot at each edge. Natalia edged her feet out and slipped down through the hole. Rourke then dropped through the hole to the floor. He glanced to the ground. The guards had moved in a piece of heavy equipment. It seemed in position. It didn't look friendly. Stepping away from the opening, they stood 16 feet from Dieter Bern's bed. Debris lay less than a foot from the bed. It had been a gamble with Bern's life, but so far they had won. More good luck. It worried him. Rourke hurried to Bern's bed, set down his medical and spare ammo bag, and opened it as Natalia bent beside Bern on the opposite side of the cot. She touched gingerly at the shackle ring about Bern's neck.
I've never seen a lock quite like this. I don't know, John.
Just be ready.
Natalia held open surgical gloves as he inserted his already powdered hands. He lifted the clamp for the artery. If he left it clamped too long, death. He chose to gamble he could work without it. The carotid was located approximately 1.5 inches below the surface of the skin. Unconsciousness would result if the artery were blocked for 5 seconds. Death would result in 12. Natalia scrubbed over the incision mark with antiseptic. Rourke drew a pre-sterilized scalpel from the sheath Natalia held for him.
If I ask for that clamp, be real quick.
Rourke merely nodded. Natalia administered the injection to render the old man unconscious. Rourke touched the scalpel to the skin, beginning the incision over the exact spot of the scar.
Sponge.
Rourke reached to Natalia's outstretched hand, drawing the sponge from the sterile packing, daubing the blood. He threw down the sponge. He thought he could see the device set beside the artery in a cyst cut in the flesh. There was no way to tell if dislodging it would cause it to explode, leading to Bern's death and the loss of Rourke's fingers. He folded back the skin flap, using his tiny forceps. It was like removing a bullet, and no more complicated than that, unless... He closed the forceps over the capsule. Then, slowly, he started to extract it. The forceps caught against the steel collar around Bern's neck.
Damn.
Here, I'll tug on it. It's coming.
Rourke twisted. Bern's body lurched once. Rourke tugged. The forceps came, and with them, the pellet. Rourke rose from his knees, ran to the hole in the wall, and flung the pellet and the forceps out through it. He returned to the cot. Mann was returning gunfire. A stray shot could trigger the photoelectric eyes. Rourke dropped to his knees beside Dieter Bern. Natalia offered a sponge. Rourke filled it with blood and threw it down to the floor beside him. He folded back the skin flap, then looked to Natalia. He took adhesive and Steri-Strips from her. No time for stitches. He closed the wound, then drew his hands back. Natalia sprayed the wound with the antiseptic healing agent Munchen gave them, along with their instruments. Natalia bandaged the incision. Rourke tore the surgical gloves from his hands.
Here, let me finish.
He completed the dressing. He glanced at Natalia's hands. The left held a probe, the right a pick, as she attacked the lock on the collar around Bern's neck. To have severed the chain by some other means and interrupted the electrical current could have triggered the claymore-type devices in the walls and ceiling, Mann told them. Rourke had no idea of the range or direction.
This isn't a normal lock, John. I don't think...
You've got to.
She looked up at him.
Yes, I do, don't I?
She peered again at the lock, working the probe.
Wait a minute. Maybe... Yes!
Hey, doctor, I can't hold them much longer. Hurry!
Rourke didn't answer. He secured the dressing in place with tape. Natalia twisted the pick.
This could take hours, but I don't think that it will.
She withdrew the pick and twisted the probe once. The lock popped open.
5 points for the RGB's Chicago espionage school, huh?
Rourke leaned across Bern's unconscious body and touched her face with his hands.
I love you very much. Always remember that. Now help me with Bern.
Natalia put away her picks as Rourke pried the collar open and slowly removed it from Bern's neck. Natalia threw down Mann's bag. Rourke reached into it for the web harness. He slipped it onto his shoulders. Natalia straightened the straps. The harness strapped across his chest, Rourke eased the unconscious old man from the cot and propped him up. Natalia took his weight as Rourke stooped. Rourke hauled Bairn up onto his back as Natalia buckled the straps and Rourke settled into the added weight.
Hurry!
Natalia ran toward the opening in the wall, Mann's bag slung again at her side. She was already clambering through the opening, the rope in her hands, and she swung away. Heavy caliber fire erupted from the ground below. Rourke looked down to the crew-served weapon. Some sort of recoilless rifle, Rourke realized.
Natalia!
She was already climbing up the wall. Rourke tucked back, Bairn's weight heavy on his back. He peered through the opening again. Natalia was nearly to the parapets. He looked up. Natalia was gone, but the rope snaked down. The rope snapped back. Rourke reached for it and caught it. He locked it into the rings at the front of the harness, then climbed through the hole, ducking lest he injure the unconscious man on his back. He tugged at the rope and felt it draw upward as he swung out, his hand gripping it through the synthetic BDU leather gloves. Natalia cranked the winch from the bag Mann carried into the building. Rourke shielded his eyes, but faced the explosion to protect Dieter Bairn with his body. Natalia continued to winch them up. They were nearly to the parapets. Natalia reached down to him. He took her hands in his. She threw her weight back, and he half fell over the parapets to his knees.
Are you all right?
I think so.
Natalia freed Bairn of the harness.
You stay.
Rourke shrugged out of the harness. Bairn was safe for the moment on the roof of the tower, one of the highest points in the complex. The parapets protected them from view. Rourke fed the winch rope down through his belt. He took the single rappelling rope, knotted his hands into it, then vaulted over and rappelled down to the opening into Bairn's cell. He kicked away, slammed back, then kicked away again to find himself back at the first opening. Rourke dropped through the opening, his left hand hooked into the climbing rope, the right full of Scoremaster, outflanking the SS who'd pinned down Mann. He rammed a fresh magazine up the butt of the Scoremaster. A fresh loaded pistol in his right fist, a nearly loaded one in his left, Rourke moved forward.
Wolf, run for it!
Mann came running along the corridor, dragging his left leg. He fired his machine pistol behind him. Rourke scooped a handful of empty shell casings from his .45 as Mann passed him, half-diving for the rope at the opening.
Use the double rope for the winch!
Mann disappeared through the opening. Rourke fired out his pistols, reached for the single rope, and hurtled through the opening. Mann swung, the rope went taut, and the winch started pulling him up. Rourke rappelled along the surface of the wall, laterally to the wall opening, as Mann closed on the parapets above, the double rope trailing behind him. Rourke took the handful of brass shells and threw them into Bairn's former cell. The cartridge casings flew toward the invisible lattice web. Rourke swung back to the double rope and caught hold of it. The sudden jerk of the winch nearly wrenched his arms from his sockets as the rope climbed to the top of the tower. Rourke glanced back and down. One of the SS security men was firing his machine pistol through the first opening. Rourke held the rope in his left fist, drew the Python with his right. Two slugs into the face of the SS man sent his body tumbling through the opening and down 14 floors. Rourke reached the parapets, lunged over, and rolled to the momentary safety of the rooftops.
John?
Rourke looked at Natalia and smiled.
So far, so good, huh?
Rourke reloaded the Scoremasters, then the Combat Masters. He dumped the cartridges from the Python, using a speed loader to replenish the cylinder.
Now what?
But Mann was already answering the question with the pocket transmitter in his hands.
This is the Wolf! Attack! Attack! Send in the Condor! Attack!
Rourke eyed the roof access hatch. He knew it was only a matter of time before SS troops crashed through it onto the roof.
We are ready, Herr Lieutenant!
Kurenami nodded, settled back, and gave the webbing harness of the seat a good luck tug. Elaine Halverson shouted something to him from beyond the perimeter of the minicopter's rotor blades. Though the prop wash drowned out the sound, it looked like, be careful. He had every intention of that. He twisted the headset's microphone into place.
Colonel Mann, the Condor is flying!
Kurenami pulled on the throttle and rotor speed increased. The mini-helicopter sprang into the sky. The Japanese pilot skimmed over the grassy plain, sweeping past Mann's troops. Kurenami flew low over them, toward the main entrance of the complex. The mission would be the most intricate flying of his life. He studied the plans for the complex on the flight down from Argentina, memorized the height of every building and the width of the opening. He neared the complex entrance and saw fighting on the ground below him. Men dressed in the steel-gray BDUs of SS Security, wearing white armbands, fought hand-to-hand with men dressed identically except for swastika armbands. The wind lashed at his face, tore at his skin. If he slowed, he'd have a better chance of threading the needle and getting through the complex doors. But if he slowed, the ground fire would have a better chance of getting to him. Kurenami throttled out all the way, threading the needle. He breathed, judging he'd missed the wall surface with his rotor blades on the port side by less than a foot. He aimed for the twin towers. What looked like a recoilless rifle fired up toward the tower on his left. Fighting was visible on the rooftop. Rourke, Natalia, and Mann ignored the incoming recoilless rifle fire as they alternated position at the top of the access hatch. Beneath them, at the bottom of the ladder, the SS bodies piled up like so many fish in a barrel. Suddenly, the SS fire stopped and the soldiers fled. Rourke stepped back and kicked the roof hatch closed. Prop wash began to kick up dust and grit from the roof. Once again, Rourke, Natalia, and Mann reloaded their weapons. Rourke finished by speedloading his Python. He dumped the emptied Safariland unit into his musette bag and ran to Dieter Bern. Kurenami hovered above in the mini-chopper dubbed Condor. While Natalia guarded the hatchway, a captured assault rifle in each hand. Rourke dropped to his knees beside Dieter Bern. He had given Bern a B-complex shot, then a mild stimulant, guessing at the overall state of the man's health. Bern was stirring now, moving as though half asleep. Mann cradled the old man's head in his arms.
We gotta get you airborne, sir.
Rourke looked to his left to watch the Condor settle. Rourke placed Bern in the chopper's jump seat behind Kurenami. He tightened the restraint harness for the semi-conscious Dieter Bern, then pulled back Bern's nearly closed eyelids. The man would be all right. He tapped Kurenami on the shoulder. The Japanese turned his head, nodded as Rourke jumped back, falling into a crouch. The machine rose. Natalia watched, an assault rifle in each hand from her station near the hatchway. Mann lay on the roof beside where she stood, a machine pistol in each of his hands. Natalia smiled. Rourke reached up as the helicopter rose, closed his hands over a skid, and chinned himself up as the helicopter lurched away from the roof. Suddenly, nothing was below them except the street, more than 20 stories below. The wind of the slipstream tore at Rourke's face, his hair. The collar tabs of the BDU blouse lacerated his cheeks and his neck. The communications building loomed ahead. As the Condor neared the roof tarmac, Rourke jumped clear, landed on the flat roof, rolled, came to his knees, then to his feet, a scoremaster in each hand as he ran to get clear of the landing helicopter. Rourke looked to the street 6 stories below. Civilians now fought alongside the uniformed men with the white armbands, all of them fighting for democracy. Rourke ran back along the roof toward the landed helicopter. Kurenami was already unbuckling Dieter Bern.
He's starting to regain consciousness, John.
I hope he doesn't time to at least talk.
The wiry Japanese naval lieutenant caught the frail Dieter Bern up into his arms.
I'm ready.
Rourke only nodded. They ran toward the roof egress doorway. They were in the communications center. Paul Rubenstein took what he considered the direct approach. With the Browning high power Madison found in the truck, he approached Dodd just as word of Madison stealing the truck reached the Eden Project commander. He put the muzzle of the high power to Dodd's head. After that, it was merely a matter of keeping it there while Dodd ordered the truck loaded with provisions from John Rourke's second pickup truck, the gear and the tents they needed, and most important, the weapons. Now, the cami-painted pickup truck was less than 8 feet away. Michael was already aboard in the back of the truck. Madison sat in the cab of the idling truck. With the gun to Dodd's head, Paul Rubenstein started to walk. Dodd's right hand slapped toward the pistol. Paul turned, tried to recover his balance, but started to fall. In that instant, hope turned to despair. You will not move, Captain Dodd.
Dr. Munchen, stay out of this. We need these vehicles and weapons. We may need these people if your German friends attack again.
Captain Dodd, as ranking officer here, I represent the interests of my commander, and I hope also the interests of reason. No helicopter can be spared to aid them. This is a military necessity, but it is a moral necessity that they try to rescue Annie Rourke. Help Herr Rubenstein to his feet, Captain, and do nothing that might provoke me to take more forceful measures.
Dodd's eyes glinted from the lamplight in the nearest tent. Then Dodd very slowly began to move. He reached down, stooping to help Paul. Paul Rubenstein held the high power in his right hand. He draped his left arm over Dodd's shoulders. The two men rose together, Dodd half-supporting Paul. They reached the truck. Paul shook his left arm loose of Dodd. With Madison's help, Paul clambered aboard and settled behind the wheel.
Captain, this isn't personal. Just as you have to be responsible for your team, we have to be for ours. Annie needs help, and we're just trying to give it to her. Good luck to you.
Yeah, well...
Paul Rubenstein released the brake and put the Ford into gear.
Dr. Munchen, God bless all of you. I hope you find what you want.
Dr. Munchen pulled himself to attention, then curtly bowed his head. And to you, Herr Rudenstein, this God, may he bless you as well in your endeavors. I am sorry that no more can be done to help.
I know that.
Paul nodded, cut the wheel hard left as he eased clutch pressure, turning out of the lamplight into the night and after Annie. Annie Rourke made her decision. She watched now as Forrest Blackburn loaded supplies aboard the helicopter. When he made his move, she would make it seem as though she realized there was no choice but to surrender to his desires. She would not make it obvious. Tears would help. He would undo the straps binding her. She would hesitate, then pretend to accept him. In the cache of gear he found, she noted several objects of interest, two M16s and a pistol in a full-flap military holster. She watched Blackburn as he checked it, cleaned it of the cosmoline-like substance that protected it. She recognized the pistol from her father's arms locker, a Beretta 92 SBF, the military 9mm adopted just before the night of the war. But the object of greatest interest lay in the sheath on the opposite side of the belt, a bayonet for an M16. She could kill him with that as he folded his arms about her, as he touched her. Natalia, yes, it was what Natalia would have done, had done. Past the knot of security forces, around the bend in the corridor, and then down a single flight of open stairs, on the second floor was their destination, the communications center. But how to get there? Rourke could see Kurenami following him through the doorway and resting his burden, Dieter Baron. Kurenami held one of the German machine pistols in his hand.
What do we do?
Rourke nodded toward the end of the hallway as he reloaded his scoremasters.
I was afraid you were going to say that. Let's go.
Kurenami charged forward, Rourke beside him, the .45 spitting, the German machine pistol firing bursts.
Banzai!
One of the SS men slapped home a fresh magazine and raised his assault rifle. Rourke, his Gerber clutched in his right hand, punched outward like a rapier thrust. Rourke withdrew the knife from the throat of the last of the security detail as he dropped to the floor. He drew the python.
I'll guard here. Go get Byrne.
You are wounded, John.
Rourke touched at his ribcage.
Oh, damn, look at that. Well, go on!
Rourke snatched up one of the assault rifles and hunted for spare magazines. He found four, fully loaded, rammed one up the empty magazine well of the rifle, and worked the action as he ran to a bend in the corridor and stopped. The assault rifle slung at his side, Rourke reloaded his pistols. He glanced behind him. Kurenami, an assault rifle suspended below his right arm, carried Dieter Baern to Rourke's side.
About the shouting bonsai back there, you know.
What about it?
Well, I always wanted to try that.
Kinda like somebody born in Texas shouting, "Remember the Alamo, huh?" Look, don't sweat it. Come on, stay behind me.
Rourke took a step forward. He tucked back.
That's not good.
Thank you, Captain Obvious. Wait, what's that?
Rourke peered past the corner.
Heitman, all right!
Rourke broke into a run.
Akiro, come on, hurry!
At least a dozen of Captain Hartman's men advanced on the genuine SS security team, driving the real SS toward Rourke. He opened fire as some of them turned again toward Rourke to return fire. Hartman's men closed to hand-to-hand range. The smell of burning flesh rode on the air and mixed with the acrid smell of the chemical propellant from the German weapons. Rourke narrowed the gap as Hartman's men beat down the last of the SS. Hartman snapped to attention as Rourke slowed and stopped. Hartman rendered a military rather than Nazi salute.
Herr Doctor, the way is clear to the nerve center of the communications area. The leader and a dozen SS hold it as the leader utilizes the television system and the radio system to appeal for support. We must go at once.
Hartman turned to his men.
You, relieve the Japanese officer of his burden. Quickly!
Hartman turned again to John Rourke, bowing slightly.
And Doctor, if you will accompany me.
What about Natalia and your Standartenführer?
I think perhaps he should be called Colonel now, Herr Doctor? Both the Colonel and the Major Chemerovna are well. They wait with the rest of my unit by the broadcast area for us to join them. You are wounded.
I creased my rib cage. I'll be stiff as hell tomorrow, but I'm fine now. Anybody's got a field dressing and some tape, I wouldn't mind it.
Hartman nodded.
You there, attend the Herr Doctor's wound. Quickly!
Rourke stopped beside a stair railing. He looked toward the position below. Natalia waved up toward him, and then so did Wolfgang Mann. Colonel Mann stood at the head of his troops, his men barricaded on both sides of the walls that funneled toward the broadcast studios. At least 24 personnel were with him, more joining him from Hartman's unit. Rourke had the BDU blouse open and pulled back on the left side. He held the shoulder rig back as the medic gingerly touched at the wound. It was shallow, but bleeding heavily. He shrugged and closed his eyes against the sudden cold of the antiseptic healing agent the trooper sprayed against the wound. He let the men position the field dressing and apply tape to secure it. He looked at the young man.
Thank you for your care.
The soldier snapped to attention and nodded.
Herr Doctor!
Rourke started down the stairwell, surveying the position below. There were enough personnel for a frontal assault, but it would take a heavy toll. Before Rourke reached the base of the stairwell, Mann was to his feet.
Follow me!
The joint forces of Hartman and Mann moved. Mann and Hartman at the forefront, machine pistols in their hands.
It's betrayal! Betrayal, justice of Führer!
Rourke took the stairs down. Natalia met him at the base of the stairs, a revolver in her left hand. Rourke leaned against her, one of the scoremasters in his right fist. They walked ahead in the wake of Mann, helped by two of his troops, Hartman and the anti-Nazi force. Rourke and Natalia passed through the shot-out entryway.
This is Colonel Wolfgang Mann. The leader is dead. I bring to you a man we all trust. A man whose every breath is a cry for freedom. Herr Professor Dieter Bern.
My fellow citizens, my fellow guardians of democracy.
Rourke sat in the leatherette swivel chair, his feet propped up on one of the communications consoles, a cup of coffee beside him. Dieter Bern's speech long since concluded. So, too, except for a few pockets of SS resistance at the far end of the complex, was the fighting. Wolfgang Mann refused immediate medical care, attempting instead to contact the remainder of his forces in North America.
This is Hauptsturmführer Helmut Mannfurtsturm. I announce this to you, Standartenführer Mann, and to all other traitors. The remainder of my force, what is left after fighting heavy Russian forces, shall embark this hour in a final attack against the Eden Project base. We know their strengths, and they cannot resist our attack. Then, Herr Standartenführer, my men and I shall return to the complex and fight you and all other traitors to fully restore our rightful system of Nazism.
John Rourke sat between Natalia and Wolfgang Mann. There was pain in Mann's eyes, but not from injury.
Helena Storm's husband, mein Gott.
John Rourke took the microphone.
Captain, this is John Rourke. I'm a doctor. I delivered twin daughters to your wife, Helena. Both your wife and your daughters nearly died at the hands of the SS under the personal direction of your leader because your son, Manfred, betrayed your wife to the leader of the youth. When Colonel Mann, Eva Mann, and the others and I rescued your wife, Captain, your oldest son was assisting in her torture. Your infant daughters were about to be mutilated before they could be born. And your three remaining sons were already prepared for torture. But they, like your wife and twin daughters, are safe now. Your son Manfred died in his attempt to stab your wife in the throat with a surgical instrument. Rourke, over.
Rourke set down the microphone and stepped away from the communications console. He picked his way over the shards of glass, the dead SS personnel. Natalia strode beside him. His left hand held her right hand tight. In the foyer beyond the communications studio was a small white column, rising perhaps 4 feet atop the column, identical except for materials to one he saw earlier outside the complex, set a bust of Adolf Hitler. John and Natalia stood before the author of evil.
I don't think anyone will want to worship him anymore.
Survivalist, The Rebellion is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 1985, Jerry Ahern. Published by arrangement with Jerry and Sharon Ahern, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2009, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Terrence Acil Ford, Mort Shelby, Nanette Savard, Michael Glenn, Karen Carbone, Eric Messner, M.B. Van Dorn, Jeff Baker, Lily Beacon, Stephen Carpenter, Colleen Delaney, Elizabeth Demery, Ken Jackson, Dolores King-Williams, James Konacek, Dylan Lynch, Scott McCormick, Tony Nam, Tom Simpson, and Kate Torrey. Additional red shirts by the Dead Giveaways. Directed by Timothy Lynch. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Chris Rowan. Adapted for graphic audio by Timothy Lynch. Original music by Chris Rowan. If you enjoyed The Survivalist, be sure to look for Ryder Stacey's Doomsday Warrior, available at road stops everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for a preview of another Graphic Audio title.
Somewhere in the mountainous jungles of Southeast Asia, there supposedly lies a vast and ancient temple complex. Within it hides a priceless artifact, a golden elephant idol with emerald eyes.
The golden elephant? So you've reason to believe that it is real?
The temple of the elephant was colossal. Our hearts were in our throats at the splendor of this marvel, this treasure, this golden elephant with emeralds for eyes. At least, there really is a temple and a golden elephant.
So, where is this lost temple of yours?
What exactly is it you have in mind?
How do you feel about crossing into Myanmar?
Anya, thank God you're here. I've been hoping against hope, you murdering little bitch! Holy shit! I know no handgun bullet will prevent you splitting me like kindling with that bloody great pig sticker, but it will be a dead or dying hand that splits me, I assure you. So for the love of God, can we talk?
That might be a worthwhile idea, but should we let ourselves lose track of why we're both here?
What do you mean?
You came to seize the golden elephant, didn't you?
Yes, didn't you?
I did.
Oh, my God.
Temple of the Elephant. Well, this changes things.
Quite.
Ladies.
Giancarlo!
Now, gentlemen.
Rogue Angel 14, The Golden Elephant. From Graphic Audio.
If you can't find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.